Well, it's been a few days now since the Israelis launched an attack on Iran. It has been telegraphed for months, if not years. It has now occurred. And last time we spoke with Dr. Iraj Abedian, who spent his formative years, in fact, right up until his early 20s, in Iran as an Iranian and is now a South African. Last time we spoke, he gave us some very useful insights into what is happening in the country of his birth. We are now hoping to get some guidance on the latest developments. Iraj, good to be talking with you. I suppose in a way, given what we spoke about last time, this must be bittersweet for you and maybe for many Iranians to see that the country is being attacked by the Israelis, but it's not really the country. It seems to be the regime. And as you told us last time, the regime's got a lot to answer for. But maybe for those who haven't watched our conversations to date, could you just give us in a nutshell what's going on in Iran, and then we can move on to the latest developments?
Thank you very much, Alec. We're talking with you again. And as you said, quite aptly, it is very difficult for me to be either impartial or sort of unemotional about what's happening to that beautiful country. The genesis of what we observe now really goes back to February 7th, 1979, where Khomeini, in a very, very spectacular way, with the support of US, UK, Germany, and France, was planted in Iran. Soon after his occupying the power or the seat of power, he announced one of the two pillars of his ideology, governance regime, if you like, was the elimination of Israel from the face of the earth. So it is not something that happened, as many commentators suggest, that it's a recent thing, or it goes back to the attack by Hamas on Israel, or any of those issues. It goes back 46 years. And then it is a very complex story. You don't have time for it, but it is important to note that two people have been central in this spectacular, almost half a century of plot, counterplot, threat, intimidation, and. These two, Netanyahu on the one hand, in his younger days, as a Mossad operator, as an intellectual, as well as Khamenei, who now is the so-called leader, spiritual leader. These are self-acclaimed titles that have been given, but he has been in a very powerful position. And when Khamenei died, then Khamenei became the successor. And since then, these two men have been pursuing existential, religion-based, fanatic confrontation of historic proportions. It has gone through different phases, and sometimes quiet, sometimes more aggressive. And during this period, increasingly, as Khamenei and the Iranian regime lost its popularity by its power base in Iran. Remember, they came to power with over 80% of people's support. Over time, they became less and less worried about people and more married to and committed to their ideology of dominating not just the Middle East region, the Islamic world, in the sense of the division between the Shias and the Sunnis. And within Shias, there is about 72 denominations, of whom the followers of Khamenei is a very, very small, aggressive, militant, and fatalistic sect. And therefore, increasingly, they became more and more aggressive, not only within Iran, with the population, as I mentioned last time, and then United Nations and all the international human rights organizations have documented report after report how brutal this regime has become with its own population. Most importantly, and perhaps ironically, and sadly, I must add, if not tragic, that apart from the elimination of State of Israel from the face of the earth, has been subjugation of women in Iran. And that's, believe it or not, is the second pillar of this regime. But that's another discussion or topic for another occasion. And be as it may, this regime has been very committed to extension or propagation, export, whatever language you prefer, of its ideology from Iran to the neighboring countries, from Middle East to Europe, from Europe to Africa, to Latin America. And this has obviously been a 45-year project. It has only recently, Alec, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, you would have noticed that Germany eventually realized that the so-called Blue Mosque in Germany was really a center of this propagation of this particular ideology. And only 4 months ago, UK, with all its intelligence, counterintelligence capability, realized that this regime had established propagation centers, getting government subsidy from UK to fight UK. I'm just giving you a flavor of how vast it has been. Over the past 45 years, this regime has managed to assassinate its opponents in Paris. The French didn't wake up to it. They did it in Greece. Nobody did anything. They did it in Germany. They did it in Austria. They did it in Belgium. And. So it has been a process of engagement using the rules of democracy to propagate their ideology. And by rules of democracy, I mean, if you set up an NPO, NGO in UK and you'll be seeing that you're promoting spiritualism and religious values and diversity and democratic engagement and so on and so forth, well, UK government will give you subsidies. So they said, okay, if that's how democracy works in UK, let's play their game and do our thing. In US, they've done the same thing and right around the globe and in Africa. In Algeria, they did nearly, back in the middle of 80s, they nearly overtook the government there before the French literally brought army and then broke it down. In Kenya, did the same thing. In West Africa, as we speak, over the past few years, there has been increasing incidences of similar type of promotion of their ideology by backing, very generously, backing the groups that are aligned with their thinking. And of course, the most damning and most consequential propagation strategy with really damage to the fabric of the Middle East society and countries has been in Lebanon with the establishment of Hezbollah, which again is public knowledge what has happened there. These, Alex, have been at the expense of the Iranian people, sending billions and billions of dollars of oil money, oil revenue, either when they could sell it to the global market or when they were embargoed through illicit the trades. All that revenue was sent to Lebanon, was sent to Iraq, was sent to Syria. And their ideology was very simple. If you want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth, you need to surround them with the axis of resistance, as they call it. In that axis, there is a religious idea and there is a military idea. The religious parties in each of these neighboring countries that encircle Israel back the Shia-aligned or better homegrown Shia leaders like Nasrallah, who would receive all the financial, military, intelligence, every other support to establish a force in Lebanon, so they become a domestic force, not a foreign mercenary group. They did the same thing in Syria. They did the same thing in Iraq. So wherever there was a core of Shia population, they identified who are Shia leaders, not all of them, Shia leaders who are aligned with their ideology, with the interpretation of Islam, as I mentioned, and they poured generous all kinds of support, financial. I mean, half of Beirut, more than half of Beirut, is built by Iranian contractors with Iranian money, furnished and given to the Hezbollah, either fighters or Hezbollah sympathizers. So Hezbollah became the dominant force in Lebanon. So Iran was very correctly arguing that this is not our force, it's based on Lebanese. And of course, it became to a point that Lebanese government became irrelevant. Iranian generals, Iranian emissaries, ministers would go to Lebanon without even contacting the president or the prime minister or anything. They would be fetched at the airport by Hezbollah, and the rest, they would do what they wanted to do. The same in Syria. So over the past nearly 50 years, this regime has established this ring of resistance, which from a military point of view was the simplest, safest, and most effective way of eliminating Israel from the face of the earth. At the same time, within the Islamic community, and it's important, I'd like to point out that Khamenei and this regime does not talk about Iran, does not talk about what is good for the nation. It doesn't have the lexicon of its engagement politically. It's not nationalistic, nor is it embedded in the Iranian history or culture or development or national welfare. That, of course, wasn't obvious back in 1979, but about 20 years ago, it became quite clear that this regime is not focused about Iran. Iran is used as a base, a powerful base, a fantastically located base for their world domination. So they talked about the world community. The lingo is about our followers. For example, Khamenei does not see himself as, nor does he ever refer to himself as being the leader, a spiritual leader or supreme leader of the Iranian Shiites. He sees himself as a supreme leader of the Islamic world. And therein arose differences with Saudi Arabia, differences with Pakistan, differences with all the Muslim countries, near and far. So in this context, this ring of resistance for the regime in Iran was a protective and combative force. They would throw money and resources at it, but it would not reach them. In other words, the enemy was way cordoned off from attacking their and their power base. So what if a few thousand or a few million people killed in Syria because they are neighbors to Israel, but they are doing our job, so we must pay them and they must get salaries and we must get monthly and stipends and so on and so forth, because they protect us, but they also allow us to continue our global domination. So Israel obviously was all along from February 79 up to today, watching every move that this regime has been making. They have been the most effective and the most frightened of players globally. They disagreed with the East and West, and they started planting their networks of agents within the belly of this regime, right from the top to the middle to the bottom. And as the gap between the regime and the Iranian people became widened, and Iranians lost their life, their developments, they could watch that their money going to Lebanon whilst they have no water. Their schools are dilapidated, but the stipend goes to Hamas or Bashar or Iraqis or Houthis, etc., etc. And then they began to rebel against this. And the more they rebelled intellectually, politically, or based on national sentiments, the more the regime became aggressive. As we speak, there are thousands upon thousands of the best of Iranian brain from right across the spectrum. Scientists, artists, poets, Nobel Peace laureates, they are rotting in prisons. And the regime became more aggressive. And as I mentioned earlier, given that the second pillar of ideology is opposition to women, women have been combative with this regime. You would recall that 3 years ago, women, in fact, right through the 45 years, women have been at the forefront of open and committed demonstration against this regime. I was still in Iran when the first women movement came out in the streets, and in tens of thousands. And of course, they were beaten, pulped to submission. And it's been frequently every 3, 4, 5 years, it's kind of resurrected in one way or another. And 3 years ago, it reached an apex where the national movement received for the first time international recognition under the title of Women, Life, and Freedom.
Raj, sorry, it's fantastic background that you've given us now. But why now? Why after nearly 50 years would Israel attack as it has done?
That's a very good question, Alec. In this background, as we speak, and as the last national elections Iran showed, that the support base of this regime is now anything between 7 to 10%. They themselves say it's 15%, but let's say 15%, 1/5. Now, if a regime loses its local base, what is left for it is military. What is left is the elimination of Israel. What is left is no longer relying on people's support, because in the evenings since 3, 4 years ago, there is continuous, this is a culture of Iran since 1970s. When you want to oppose the regime, at night they go on the roof and they say death to the Shah during the Shah. And now over the past few years has been on the rooftop, literally, not figuratively, shouting death to the dictator or death to Khamenei or death to whoever they want to oppose, because they are not allowed in the streets. Because they go in the streets, they mow them like as if they are rats. Rooftop opposition has been part of the growing culture of Iranian expression of interest. Now, the regime is left with a country, 90 million, of whom, whatever number you prefer, 60 million, 70 million of them, 80 million of them, depending what percentage you see them as supporting them, they are actively or through rooftop expression of interest, they are against the regime. And they are against the regime because they are suffering, not just in terms of human rights. Their quality of life has all but disappeared. Inflation has been over the past 10 years, 50%, 60%, over the past 6 months, 200%. And Iranians are not used to this type of lifestyle, nor are they used to historically, culturally, to be quiet. So regime now has find itself really left on one hook for its survival, and that is to ramp up its opposition against Israel, to create a kind of foreign enemy that can around which to rally local support. The people are now wiser than that. People understand that this is all a game. This is also a game of bluff and bluster. This is not real, and this is not good for them, because Iranian people have got nothing to do with the Israeli people. Maybe Netanyahu and Khamenei go back 40 years wanting to prove their points, but the Iranian people have absolutely no sympathy or any reason that we don't share any borders, we don't have any historic relevance or arguments, nothing of any sort. If anything, it's a historic biblical evidence that Iranian kings always liberated the Jews. Jews have remained grateful for it up to today, recognizing it. And it's part of their Old Testament. It's not a just historic, secular, but deeply religious facts that they appreciate. And likewise, in Iran, there are a lot of cultural linkages with the Jewish history. There are Jewish cultural and scientific relationship that they revered in Iran up to today. So why now? Because this regime has left with nothing. Its hand has become really more than revealed if you're a poker player. And you can bluff and bluster up to a point. To the point, Alec, to my sadness, that even the European Union now suddenly realizes that, hey, this regime has been fooling them. And even UK has realized, never mind people who suffer from it. So, and Khamenei is reaching the end of it, or towards the end of his life, he is in late 80s, and yet he hasn't managed to beat the enemy. Netanyahu, on the other hand, as you know, has been fighting with this ring of what he calls it, ring of fire, or what George Bush Jr. called it, axis of evil. And so whether you want to call it axis of evil, ring of fire, on the one side of the table, Khamenei and his clique call it ring of resistance, or the Shia Crescent. That's another. These are all language used. And of course, as finally the International Nuclear Agency admits that for the past 20 years, and definitely for the past 10 years, Iran has become non-compliant and non-responsive to the queries that the agency has been putting to them. And that's quite obvious. These mullahs, the ideology, the modus operandi is a better term. The modus operandi of Ayatollahs for 700 years in Iran has been deceit, promise, do what you want to do in any case. Say what is good, what will fool people, what fool the king, so to speak, and yet go back and do what you want to do, which is part of your plot. This is not a new thing. This is not a 50 or 40 year cultural thing. It's a 700 year DNA of this particular clique.
It's like the end is justified by the means. It's something that is used often by people with very deep ideology. Iraj, there are a lot of parallels here with South Africa, which we can't really go into, but what is going to happen next? We've seen the Israelis with this lightning assault. If you were a part of the regime in Iran, you had to have expected something to happen, but whatever they expected didn't work out that way. A lot of them have been assassinated. But where to from here?
I like the parallel with South Africa, if I may briefly comment on it, because it's so apt for me that has lived half of my life there, and more than half here. It's been when apartheid regime used to attack Angola and have a big fight, throw resources at it and lose soldiers or kill people. It was seen as a South African war. It was like a Groot Gevaar type of ideology. But it wasn't a South African war. It was an Angolan war. South African people and Angolan people had nothing to do with that war. It's exactly identical to what we see now. It's not a battle between Iran and Israel, nor is it between the people and people. It's about a regime that has a specific ideology which is rejected and rotten at the same time inside. So where to from here? It is going to be a long, protracted engagement. Netanyahu and Israeli intelligence services know that it's like the European middle-aged duel that people used to make. You go to a duel and not to fight and bruise and come and make peace, one of you comes out live and the other one goes horizontal. And that's because it's existential. It is not a differences of opinion. This is about Netanyahu saying, if we lose this battle, no matter what Americans promise us, no matter what the Russians tell us, no matter what the region assures us, we know that this particular ideology is going to wipe us out. And therefore, we have only one option. This is their argument. Back home, this regime has lost its legitimacy. It's lost its power base. It's squandered, Alec, based on their own estimates. And be prepared for this. $2 trillion over the past 24 years. $2 trillion in pursuit of a protective shield on based on one assumption, that if we have nuclear bomb, nobody, even America, will dare to attack us. And behold, North Korea. That's how you survive. Doesn't matter people like you or not. As long as you're protected against the superpowers and regional powers, that's what you should do, because it's a survival of the regime, not the prosperity and development of the nation and the country and the region that matters, nor do they care about stability of the region. In fact, they have been the engine, as I mentioned, of creating instability. They have attacked the oil facilities of Saudi Arabia. They have attacked Pakistan. They have attacked everybody that they could in order to, and of course, Iraq and so on and so. So I think where to from here is, I wish I knew, but what I do know, and I have no doubt, that the mullahs, for the first time in 46 years, they are fighting for their existence. So for them, it's no longer a religious ideology. It's for their existential families, people, and their existence, and of course their domination. For Netanyahu and the state of Israel is also existential. So you have now a duel happening, the like of Middle East, but with new technology. Not Middle East, Middle Ages, with two powers, two claimants on authority and existence, and one of them will come out dominant and the other one will go flat. How long it will take is not going to be a quick thing. It's not a quick thing because the Israelis, as I mentioned, from day one, they have been within the belly of this regime, knowing where their sites are, where their weapons are, where they are sourcing, what the Germans are selling them, what the Italians are selling them, what the Chinese are selling them. They are embedded. And therefore, unless they wipe out every trace of the power base, not from a political point of view, from a military and security point of view, every factory that produces anything that's got to do with missiles or with weapons or with anything, they will destroy it. And the way that they have done it in Lebanon, you saw the brutal, ruthless way in which they demolished, not just immobilized, but decimated the Hezbollah. You've seen what they've been doing in Gaza. You've seen what they've done in Syria. So where it will go, unfortunately, and my heart shivers as I'm speaking to you, that this is not going to be a pretty picture, nor is it going to be as simple as Mr. Trump would like it to be, or Mr. Putin saying, I'm going to call and somebody will say, yes, let's sit around the table. These two cannot coexist in the region.
Mm. When you, just to close off with, hear the rumors or speculation that South Africa has been helping the mullahs, and let's call them that, the regime in Iran, to build their nuclear weapons, given that South Africa had nuclear weapons in the apartheid era and then voluntarily disbanded them. Do you think there's any truth in that, given that I suppose if you can build it once, you should be able to pass on plans to someone else to be able to build it?
Alec, the reality is that I don't have any evidence, but I'm not sure if they need South Africa. They got the blueprint from a Pakistani nuclear scientist. Back in late 1980s, early 1990s, Abdul Qadir, I think was his name. He died in Abdul Qadir Khan, the father of Pakistani nuclear energy. He gave them the blueprint. And interesting enough, like when he did, a few years later, when all those drawings and all the formulas and all the processes in a half a ton of documents, 500 kgs, north of Tehran, it was put in a storerooms, specially built buildings and so on and so forth. The Israelis broke into it, stole it at night, flew it to Tel Aviv, and up to today, they've had it and they've shared it with IA. So it's not, they don't need South African. I don't know, I have no evidence, but if I was in their shoes, I would, whether it's North Korea or any scientist I can get from anywhere to speed up the process, I would do it. But do they need the South African support? No. Do they need North Korean support? No. They got the blueprint, and I have, without sounding too nationalistic, I have full confidence in the brilliance of Iranian scientists to do the best that they can to build it. And they have done it spectacularly. So I think that would be my view. I don't think South Africa officially would need to get involved. Would some scientists, some technicians, some supervisors who were in the previous bomb making in South Africa would be hired to do? Possibly.
Maybe. Yeah. I suppose like security personnel who might have certain skills could be used other parts of the world. Yo, Iraj, it's a big story. There's also a massive exposure from one of our major listed companies, MTN. It has the cell phone license in Iran. Would you fancy their chances of coming through this intact?
Look, I've been told, I don't know how true it is, that over the past few years, MTN has been trying desperately to dislodge itself from Iran, selling its stake to a local consortium, but they have difficulty getting their money out for obvious reasons. This is a trick that I could have told them when they started these discussions. Their intention has been quite clear and maybe honorable, but their ability from a business point of view is almost, I would give it zero probability. They are stuck there and they remain stuck there. And of course, you know, there's a legal battle around that. There is corruption in the background. And because in Iran, you cannot do anything business-wise more than opening a corner cafe without corruption being involved, no matter who you are. Whether you are Turks, American, Italian, or South Africans, you cannot have a contract of that nature so sensitive and so central without massive corruption involved. Of course, if this regime falls, and when it falls, MTN will be out without compensation. They'll end up doing exactly what they did in Syria. Remember, that was a $2 billion or $1.7 billion investment. They had to just drop it and move on, write it off, because they will never be allowed in my lifetime in Syria again. And in Iran, unfortunately, MTN would have the same fate. They are seen as an ally of this brutal, repressive regime, and all their allies in the corporate and in the political world will have a difficult time when and if this regime falls.
When you say when and if, is there sufficient resistance or even organized resistance within Iran to play a factor in all of this?
Yes and no. There are many groupings inside and out, but as I'm sitting here, there is no obvious successor. But that doesn't mean much. Remember when you and I had a discussion about Syria? I said it's going to fall. Don't ask me who is going to come. Nobody that I knew, or at least openly anybody knew, that somebody would pop up here overnight become the leader and president in waiting, or interim president of Syria, and the rest is history. I do not know. I have no intelligence about who has been for years groomed by different forces to pop up at the right time to do the right thing. Of course, Iran is not Syria. It's a far bigger, more complex society. And therefore, I cannot at the moment sitting here with any evidence or with any confidence to suggest that which group will dominate. What I can tell you without fear of contradiction, that this regime has zero chance of success because it's lost its power base. It survives and has survived over the past 15 years through one factor and one factor alone, and that is brutal intimidation, murder, and oppression of its opposing people within the country.
And that's not sustainable in any society, at least of all such a highly civilized one as the Iranian society is. But what about South Africa's role right now? We hear our foreign minister, who Neil de Beer says has got one brain cell which has gone to sleep, saying that condemning the invasion or the attack by Israel on Iran. I guess we shouldn't say South African foreign minister, the ANC foreign minister. Is he just misreading the room again?
I think the issue challenge is not just for South Africa. Saudi Arabia, South Africa, even EU, they all, China, Russia, they all have condemned the Israeli attack on Iran. That's easy. But if you don't put the context in place, if you do not put it brutal and honest as the situation is, you can only do through diplomatic channels, at least you need to do in terms of the international law, condemn the action. Because as far as the international law is concerned, a small country like Israel, 2,300 kilometers away from Iran, shouldn't invade. But the flip side of it is a country the size of Iran should not, as part of its policy, put the elimination of another UN member country as part of its political ideology, its military and security and government policy for 45 years. Because during these 45 years, South Africa and all other countries didn't really take this matter seriously. They sat with their fellow ministers or presidents, and in BRICS they sat down knowing that that president has got a policy or pursues a policy of eliminating another country. When it will blow up, nobody knew. But that it had to blow up, at least I had, and many others, millions of others, had no doubt. So it's when you forget the rules of diplomatic engagement, peacemaking, and then you wait until the two get to fight. At that point, you condemn one of them. You come across as not having paid attention to the history of it, not having understood the historic roots of it, nor do you understand the political existential consequences for both parties, not just for Iran, but also for Israel. It's in that context that diplomatic engagement now has to be a lot more complex and not so simplistic.
Fascinating. Iraj, thank you for the insights into the big story, the big global story of the moment. Dr. Iraj Abedian was the former chief economist at Standard Bank. He's an entrepreneur, the founder of Pan-African Capital, and a very respected academic. And as I mentioned at the outset, he is from Iran. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.